The headlines. British officials put several armed Navy boats on standby to help protect the UK's fishing waters in case of a no-deal Brexit. A senior U.S. Republican Party official calls for formation of a union by, quote, law-abiding states after the Supreme Court rejected a bid to overturn election results.
Justice for Casey!
Justice for Casey!
Anti-racism protesters rally in the U.S. city of Columbus, calling for justice in last week's fatal police shooting of a black man. Thanks for joining us. Britain's Royal Navy boats are being prepared to protect the country's fishing waters in case the UK and the EU fail to reach a post-Brexit trade deal. The vessels are on standby to guard British waters from EU fishermen in case of a no deal on fishing rights after the Brexit transition period ends on December the 31st. Navy officers will also be allowed to board foreign vessels and arrest fishermen. Fishing has been one of the sticking points in talks, which are fast approaching their end on Sunday, with both sides saying no agreement is likely. Meanwhile, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said the talks over a post-Brexit trade deal with the EU are deadlocked.
The argument today is about the terms on which we trade with the European Union. And the issue at the moment is that they want, the talks in Brussels are stymied, deadlocked, because they want to keep us locked into a system by which every time they change their laws, we have to change our laws. And we don't think that's a brilliant idea.
Johnson said, however, the British companies will enjoy big opportunities in case of a no-deal Brexit. The EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen also told bloc leaders that a no-deal is the most likely scenario. Meanwhile, the Irish Prime Minister, Michael Martin, said that his country still hopes a last-minute deal. Speaking after an EU meeting in Brussels, Martin said that the Irish economy would be damaged in the event of a no-deal Brexit. Johnson and von der Leyen have given negotiators until Sunday evening to break the current deadlock. Richard Sedan is a correspondent joining us from London. So you have the Royal Navy boats preparing to protect the country's fishing waters in case there is no deal. Tell us more first about that.
It's a pretty unbelievable spectacle. Why? What an incredible headline. I mean, here we are, looking at the prospect of, I think, four UK Navy ships patrolling UK waters in the event that French fishermen and others might encroach into British fishing rights. You know, the reality of this story is the UK government has had years to iron out all of these problems, and there are going to be more problems like this one. And of course, it hasn't done that. And now the eventuality of a no-deal Brexit is ever more materialising on the horizon. And I think there's a kind of irony for a lot of people, really, because obviously Britain has a deep kind of colonial past, and here it is flexing its military muscle in its own waters ahead of Brexit.
So what's going to happen at this point in terms of a no deal? It appears, obviously, that that's going to be the case. What are the types of preparations is the UK taking in order to prepare itself? Because we know that, obviously, there's going to be certain sectors that are going to be affected deeply, such as some of the everyday needs in grocery stores, etc.
Exactly. So from the get-go, the government has made pains to sort of say that it's kind of covered all the eventualities, all of the problems that might result from Brexit. But for example, we know from different think tanks, different analysts, for example, there are going to be likely serious food shortages and also medicine shortages in the north of England. And many of the areas that are going to experience these problems actually are areas which voted for Brexit. So we know the government is saying one thing, but I'm afraid all the evidence, if you look at most of the different analysts from across the board, economic analysts, they're going to tell you Britain's going to take a hit. And yet there are certain areas that are going to feel it, and those areas, many of them traditional working class areas, which actually voted for Brexit.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Richard Sudan there talking to us from London. Thanks, Richard. The head of the Republican Party in the U.S. state of Texas has suggested forming a union after the country's apex court rejected a lawsuit seeking to overturn the presidential election results. In a statement, Alan West said the Supreme Court's order had established a precedent that allows states to violate the Constitution and not be held accountable. He said law-abiding states should form a union that will abide by the Constitution. This came after the top court tossed up the Texas's lawsuit to overturn Joe Biden's victory in the states of Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The ruling is considered as a crushing setback for incumbent President Donald Trump's quest to undo his election loss to Biden. Trump's team has already suffered multiple court defeats in similar cases in other states. However, Trump still refuses to concede continuing fraud claims.
In a historic first, 18 states, led by Texas, sued four states over the long-running controversy of mail-in ballots. It was by far the most serious challenge yet to the integrity of the recent U.S. presidential election. The crux of the lawsuit was not related to the widespread allegations of, so far unproven, criminal conspiracy to commit voter fraud, but a question of constitutional law. The lawsuit asserted that constitutional law was broken months ago when some state governors bypassed state legislatures via executive order to issue unprecedented numbers of mail-in ballots. However, just 3 days before the Electoral College votes to decide the president, the Supreme Court rejected the lawsuit in a huge win for the projected victory of challenger Joe Biden. Biden supporters voiced relief and exasperation that election challenges are continuing for so long.
The real issue is there's no merit to the case. Why are we doing this? How many court cases do they have to be satisfied? There's probably going to be 25% of this public that still will never believe that he won that. But he did, fair and square.
Trump supporters are likely to now criticize the Supreme Court for allegedly playing politics and for not agreeing to hear the case in public. The lawsuit had been joined by the incumbent Donald Trump, two-thirds of all Republicans in the House of Representatives, and polls consistently show that 80% of Republican voters still believe challenger Joe Biden's projected win was due to vote fraud.
I don't think people accepted the results of the last election, so I think just as a two-party country, you're always going to have people that oppose it no matter what, and that will continue to happen no matter who won the election.
What's certain is that this is not the last election-related dispute. The lawsuit indicates the depth of grassroots and elite support for more unprecedented legal battles in order to decide who is the rightful president in this ever more divided nation. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Americans have hit the streets in the state of Ohio to demand transparency in the investigation of the fatal police shooting of a black man.
Justice for Casey!
The protesters chanted slogans against police racism as they marched toward the Ohio State House in the city of Columbus. 23-year-old Casey Christopher was killed last week after a sheriff's deputy shot him multiple times outside of his home. Authorities and the victim's family have offered conflicting stories about the event leading to his death. Anger mounts despite Columbus officials promising an unbiased investigation into his death. This is the latest in a series of police killing of African Americans in the U.S. The country has witnessed mass protests against racial injustice and police brutality in the past months. Political analyst Alexander Azotgan says police brutality is systematic and remains rampant in the U.S. no matter who is in the White House.
The approach of Mr. Biden, President-elect Biden, is quite different than Mr. Trump. He is more reconciliatory. He would play a comforting role like most U.S. presidents traditionally carried when there were incidents like this. But this is much bigger than the White House or who occupies the White House. We're talking about systematic racism. We're talking about shooting first and not really worrying about the investigation while the shooting is actually taking place in front of the camera. And then we have the problem with the police union who whitewashes everything and somehow creates some kind of a barrier between, real law being implemented to these police officers and at the very least for them to be fired. So this is much bigger than whether there's a Democrat or a Republican in the White House. We're talking about something that's encompassing, it's systematic. we're talking about the fact that the system itself, the structure in this country knows that the country is on the verge of a revolution, and that it does everything and anything to make sure this doesn't happen by setting examples of all these poor innocent people so they wouldn't rise.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has authorized the emergency use of a COVID-19 vaccine jointly produced by American drug maker Pfizer and its chairman partner, BioNTech. The approval will pave the way for millions to be vaccinated in the world's hardest-hit country. The coronavirus pandemic has killed nearly 300,000 Americans so far. The U.S. is seeking to inoculate 20 million people this month. Healthcare workers and elderly people in care facilities are at the front of the line to receive shots. The U.S. is now the sixth country to approve the vaccine after Britain, Bahrain, Canada, Saudi Arabia, and Mexico. The government says it is buying 100 million more doses of a second vaccine produced by Moderna. The two-shot regimen could be approved as early as next week. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has moved forward with a major arms sales to Morocco. The package is worth $1 billion and includes drones and precision-guided weapons. The White House has reportedly sent a notice to Congress about the potential deal. This would be among the first drone sales under the Trump administration. The move comes after Washington announced a U.S. brokered agreement for the normalization of ties between Morocco and Israel. Earlier this year, the U.S. offered F-35 jet fighters to the United Arab Emirates as part of a deal to establish diplomatic relations with Israel. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has condemned Morocco's decision to normalize ties with Israel, pledging continued support for the Palestinian cause. Hezbollah branded normalization deals with Tel Aviv as treacherous steps in line with the U.S. and the Israeli regime's desire to eradicate the Palestinian cause. The resistance movement said that Morocco and a few other Arab states, which have normalized ties with Israel, will gain nothing but disappointment from the submission to U.S. and Israeli blackmail. Hezbollah also warned that Muslim nations continue to reject all forms of normalization with Israel and will ensure the deals will fall apart.
Morocco has become the fourth Arab country to normalize relations with Israel since August in a U.S. brokered agreement. U.S. President Donald Trump announced the agreement on Twitter Thursday. He said Rabat and Tel Aviv have agreed to fold diplomatic relations, calling the move a historic breakthrough. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also called the deal historic. Morocco said under the agreement, it will take concrete steps to resume a relationship with Israel on several levels. In return, the U.S. decided to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over the entire Western Sahara. The Polisario Front independence movement that holds a fifth of the region strongly condemned the deal. The movement said Trump has attributed to Morocco something that does not belong to the country. Palestinians denounced the agreement too. The Palestine Liberation Organization said Morocco's decision was unacceptable. It said the move will increase Israel's belligerence and its denial of the Palestinian people's rights. Resistance movement Hamas said Israel uses every new normalization deal to increase its aggression against Palestinians. The Islamic Jihad movement also denounced Morocco's decision as a betrayal to the Islamic and Arab world. In Yemen, the Ansar Allah movement said there isn't any justification for Arab states to establish ties with Israel. Inside Morocco, many people are critical of normalization with Israel. During a demonstration in the capital Rabat in September, protesters called Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates treacherous countries for establishing diplomatic relations with Israel. Many believe U.S. brokered normalization agreements aim to eliminate Palestinians from the entire region.
Israel doesn't want peace. Israel wants territory, power, and it wants genocide. It wants to eliminate Palestinians, preferably 100%. If not by killing them, then by making them forget that they're Palestinian.
The UAE announced its decision to establish diplomatic ties with Israel in August. In return, Washington provided Abu Dhabi with F-35 fighter jets. Bahrain and Sudan followed suit, with Sudan being removed from the U.S. blacklist of terrorism-sponsored countries. On Thursday, White House senior advisor Jared Kushner said a similar deal is inevitable between Israel and Saudi Arabia. For now, it's unclear what privileges Riyadh will be given to normalize relations with Tel Aviv.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says that his government is taking all necessary measures for the production of a coronavirus vaccine domestically. Rouhani said the government is ready to fully assist science-based organizations doing researches on COVID vaccines. He added that Iran is willing to purchase a vaccine from abroad once it is approved by the country's health ministry. The Iranian president, however, called on citizens to abide by health protocols and avoid gatherings, especially during the upcoming ceremonial events. He stressed that asymptomatic patients and those having no clear signs of the virus would pose greater threat to the people. Rouhani also hailed Iranian experts and specialists for their help in dealing with the deadly disease inside the country. Iran has executed a man who was convicted of corruption on Earth, a charge used in cases involving serious offenses like espionage or attempts to overthrow the government. Ruhollah Zam was sentenced to death by a court in June after several sessions. Zam faced charges of committing offenses against the country's internal and external security, spying for the French intelligence agencies, and insulting Islamic sanctities. He had also created an anti-Iran website, Ahmad News, which was found publishing misleading contents against the Islamic Republic. Authorities say that his online work helped inspire deadly anti-government protests in 2017. Zam left for France in 2009 following the post-election unrest in Iran. He was arrested last year and enticed back to the country through a complicated intelligence trap.
Death penalty. This was the sentence handed down to Ruhollah Zam for administrating a news website that Iran's judiciary says disseminates misleading content against the Islamic Republic. Ahmad News came to prominence during Iran's nationwide protests in 2017, which were driven by economic grievances. The Iranian government says the news network was inciting, quote, armed uprising against the establishment while spreading damaging information about government officials.
During the 2017 unrest in Iran, Ahmad News Telegram channel frequently shared the time schedule for protests across Iran and detailed how they went down. It also regularly published videos from the protests, and Ahmad News Terwat was a peaceful demand for economic reforms into violent protests which were associated with vandalism and looting.
Zam left Iran for France following the 2009 post-election unrests in Iran. The Iranian judiciary says he was under the instructions and protection of intelligence services of France, Israel, and the U.S. Zam faced charges of having committed offenses against Iran's internal and external security, spying for the French intelligence service, and desecrating Islamic sanctities.
Ruhollah Zam was actually a small piece of a large puzzle that sought to bring about a regime change in Iran. I believe he fell into a trap spread by the CIA, Mossad, and especially the French intelligence agency. He became part of the United States' so-called 2020 project that was aimed at toppling the Islamic Republic through a soft war in a three-time mark of 1999, 2009, and finally 2019.
Zam was arrested in October 2019 by the intelligence organization of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The IRGC says Zam was detained after being enticed into the country as part of a complicated intelligence trap. Iran's Supreme Court upheld the death sentence 5 months after the Islamic Revolution Courthouse issued the verdict for corruption on Earth, a term used to describe capital crimes within the Iranian judicial system.
Meanwhile, Ahmad News is still up and running, something which gives some clues that Zam was just a pawn in a wider game, orchestrated from outside Iran's borders. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And that is World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Once every 100,000 years, gold is created from the collision of neutron stars. Mysterious gold instantly melted into humanity's desire to contain the magic which enabled civilizations to flourish and fueled the desire that made people venture across oceans. But why do we lust after gold? And does humanity own gold, or does gold own humanity? I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. For centuries, gold was the economic index which dominated the world before it lost to the dollar. But the 2008 financial meltdown has brought gold back from oblivion. Gold is now dominating the world once again, but why is it gold again? In 2008, gold woke up from its deep, dark sleep. As the dollar became unstable during the U.S. financial crisis, people rushed to gold. And in August of 2011, the twisted destiny recurred. The new gold rush started again. Pursuit has begun once again, and stay with us as we take a look into the history of gold from its glittering past to its sudden return.
Gold.
That is gold.
King guy. King or gold.
Gold.
With gold.
Gold.
In oro.
The oro.
Oro.
Into gold.
Sold gold.
Gold.
Gold price.
Gold mines.
Gold is undervalued.
Currency which reflects human instincts is very much alive. Money gained humanity's passionate desire since its creation. Money was at the center of wars and economies. Its origin can be traced back to Mesopotamia. Thousands of years ago, Sumerians were the first ever to develop trade. Since then, many types of currency have appeared in history. Trading goods for goods appeared first. Grains, essential for everyone, were used as currency in many areas. As time passed, smaller objects were used for trading to facilitate easier transportation and exchange. Various metals became the new currency, as they were easily transportable and did not rot. But not all metals were permanently stable. In the end, gold, whose value was accepted consistently as a stable metal, became the best currency. Gold, which is evaluated by its weight and purity, has no exchange rate or nationality. Due to its high value, large trades were made possible with just small amounts of gold. It was the best currency that was accepted everywhere. In 700 BC, the kingdom of Lydia, which ruled Turkey, became the birthplace of the best invention in the history of currency. The capital of the kingdom was Sardis. It was the hub of the East and West, and as trading became important, the need for currency grew. Lydia dominated Asia Minor. It expanded its boundaries as the ancient empire, securing the trade route linking an area of over 2,700 kilometers. Lydia invented the world's first gold coins, using their abundant resources of gold, and built an affluent kingdom.
And this started with King Croesus of Lydia, which is a very famous name, and he really produced the first gold coins and used it particularly to pay soldiers and military people.
In the early 7th century BC, Lydians minted the world's first coins. Gold coins, which feature a lion's head, the symbol of Lydia, became the kingdom's representative export goods. As the world's first gold coins and the world's first empire currency, Lydia's coins spread through Asia Minor and Greece. They became a necessity for trade in the Mediterranean. Goods, art, people, and knowledge gathered in Lydia, and humanity's first retail businesses began. With a single shiny gold coin, people were able to buy horses or delicious food. It also reduced shopping time. A new world had opened up for humanity. But if the Lydians were the first to invent coins, the Greeks were the first to turn coin making into an art form. Each city imprinted its own unique symbols. They were the symbols of national strength. Greek coins circulated the Mediterranean through marine commerce. Gold coins brought revolutionary developments in commerce and became the foundation of civilizations. Education also developed quickly along with the coins. Five 500 years after the birth of gold coins, the currency revolution moved to Rome. Coins featuring the emperor's face, as well as other royalty, were widely used among laymen. As the territory of the Roman Empire expanded, the amount of gold attained through looting and mining grew exponentially. Consequently, the Romans issued more gold coins, and these coins strengthened the empire. Gold coins were what built the Roman Empire. In 395 AD, after the Roman Empire divided into two, Western Rome collapsed within the next 100 years. However, the surviving Eastern Rome continued to write history for another 1,000 years. Constantine the Great moved Rome's capital to Byzantium and founded the Byzantine Empire. Constantine the Great, who reunited Rome, declared freedom from religion and chose Sunday as a day of rest. He also issued a new gold coin called Solidus. This is Byzant, the best currency. The Byzant, with a 98% purity, weighed 4.5 grams. The Byzant was the basic currency of the Middle Ages that everyone could trust and use. It was the longest surviving currency in history.
Really ran from about 500, well, really 300 AD, but 500 AD in Istanbul itself, and lasted for almost 1,000 years, really with the weight and the purity of it unchanged. There were some years when it was a problem, but it did last almost for 1,000 years, the Byzantine solidus. It was a thousand year coin, if you like.
The Byzant was the revenue source to maintain a large army and the means of controlling the empire. That is why the Byzant is called the dollar of the Middle Ages. The dollar of the Middle Ages surpasses today's dollar in terms of stability and value. While today's dollar faced a crisis within 100 years, the Byzant survived for 1,000 years. The Byzant was the partner that supported the kingdom for 1,000 years. The value of gold transcends time and space and gives faith to people. But there was a critical weakness even to gold, the best currency. There is a limit to the production of gold, and there are three ways to overcome the limit. One was to endure the lack of currency, and the other was to bring in gold from other regions through trade and loot. The last method was currency degradation, by making more coins with the same amount of gold. People began to deceive others by making new coins using clipped edges of existing coins.
And up until 1696, coins were struck onto a rough blank. So you used to be able to, if you were a very unscrupulous silversmith, you could clip the edges and get free silver. And so there were many laws that were passed to try and stop this. And in 1696, what they did was that they made sure that all the coins were circular with a milled edge. So that stopped the practice of coin clipping.
This is the origin of how the coin edges look today. Clipping of coin edges brought many problems. The value of currency fell, and prices began to inflate. New coins had to be issued to win people's trust. Sir Isaac Newton stepped up to solve all these problems.
And one of his big responsibilities was to prevent forgery. So one of the ways he did that was by making sure that all the coins had a milled edge around them, because if the edge is milled with little grooves, it's impossible to clip off a little bit of the coin.
The grooves on the coins that Newton made are used on today's coins as well. The grooves mark the human greed for gold. Gold, however, was never used as the main currency in the East. As the value of gold developed the currency system in the West, brass coins backed by the government played a similar role in the East. Whether it be gold or a brass coin, if the receiver had trust in it, that was enough. People had faith in the government. The first coins in the East were made during the Jin Dynasty. They believed the sky was round and the land was square, so they made a round coin with a square hole in the middle. This shape became the basic shape of Eastern coins for 2,000 years. The trust of currency gave birth to the world's first paper money in China. Gyoza, issued in Buxong in 1023, was the first paper money. When Emperor Kublai Khan of the Yuan Dynasty mass-produced bozhou and circulated them through Eurasia, the era of paper currency began. Paper money was made of paper, but it ceased to be just ordinary paper. Kublai Khan is described as an alchemist in the travels of Marco Polo. Paper currency was like magic to the Westerners who were using gold coins. During the Yuan Dynasty, the government forcefully retained gold, silver, and copper, and with its guarantee, paper money was issued. With the circulation of paper money, less money was spent on producing coins, which led to a better financial status of the government, and thus led to a more active commerce. Replacing the gold with paper money opened up a new golden era in the East. At the end of the 15th century, gold had cast a spell on people and made them cross the oceans, risking their lives. But the lives of Europeans were also shaken up by gold. At the time, the population, which had been devastated by the plague, was bouncing back. Price of commodities was also increasing. Moreover, as gold and silver from the New World poured into Europe, prices soared uncontrollably. The price revolution of the 16th century began. Treasure from the New World created a large gap between the rich and the poor.
And this is at a time when that is much more than a week's earnings in the late. It's more like 2 weeks' earnings. So it is a lot of time to earn the smallest coin. And therefore, ordinary people do not have gold coins. It is something for the rich to have.
Prices quadrupled and sextupled. First, landowners who received a consistent amount of rent went bankrupt. Farmers who didn't have money to rent land became wage laborers. On the other hand, the royal families and noblemen enjoyed an unprecedented extravagance. Gold instantly spread throughout European countries, and in its wake, only collapsed industries and financial crisis remained. Such was the curse of gold. The price revolution continued on for over 100 years without any resolution. It was the longest inflation in history. When commerce expanded and capitalism developed, a barter economy emerged. A system of an exchange of promissory notes for foreign currency began. 48 types of gold coins used in Europe in the 16th century were all exchangeable. Thus, financial innovation was propelled by the power of gold. In the early 19th century, gold faced a new era. Money was dependent upon the value of gold. A system of gold and money exchange emerged. Since then, history repeatedly introduced and discarded the gold standard. In 1819, England pegged the value of pounds to gold and circulated paper money that could be exchanged for gold at any time. By 1870, most countries had adopted the gold standard, and the pound, which could be exchanged for gold, became the key currency around the world.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. My brothers and sisters in faith, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. One of the sufferings in life, and one that Islam does not overlook, as a matter of fact, discusses it thoroughly and often, is the matter of poverty. Unfortunately, it's something that so many of us are struggling with. And even though we are taught to be content with what Allah decrees for us, we are also taught to strive and try for the best. There are certain ways that one can change a situation of destitute and deprivation, which Islam teaches us. We will talk about that after a short story regarding one of our great scholars. So we're going to be right back.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, dear brothers and sisters, so welcome to this program entitled Lantern. We have a new and interesting story for today. What's the title? The Sacrifice of Muhaqqiq Ardabili, one of the great scholars in the Islamic world. It is related that Muhaqqiq Ardabili, during the times of the famine, used to give away to the poor whatever he had. He used to live in poverty himself. One day, when he had donated all his possessions, his wife became angry with him that he had deprived his children in such times when food was scarce. He left his home and went to the mosque and sat there in i'tikaf. An unknown person arrived at the door of his house and handed sacks of wheat and flour, saying that Master Ardabili sent it and that he was in i'tikaf at the mosque of Kufa. When Muhaqqiq Ardabili returned home from i'tikaf, his wife told him that he had sent very fine wheat and flour. When he learned of the details, he realized that it was a divine favor upon him, and he fell down in prostration to thank the Almighty. Many times it was seen that Muhaqqiq left home with an expensive turban, but if he encountered a beggar, he tore a piece from it and gave it in alms. On numerous occasions, he returned home bareheaded.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So the story was the story of Muhaqqiq Ardabili, and he was a great man. I mean, it's not just through this story, he has written volumes and volumes of books, and he has paved the way for many more discoveries and deeper understandings of our religion, and has established milestones for those who would come in future generations. However, the focus of today's story is regarding his generosity. And this is actually one of the attributes of all great men and women. Generosity is, a matter of fact, one of the qualities of the prophets and apostles. The Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam are known for their generosity. Just to understand the importance of generosity, during the time of the noble prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, there were a group of people who, like, disbelievers who were plotting to assassinate His Holiness. And through revelation, Rasulullah was made aware of their scheme, and it was foiled, and they failed, and they were all killed save one. The person who was spared later on approached Rasulullah and asked him that I was among those people who were planning to kill you as well. We sharpened our swords, we wanted to come attack you, whatever the case was. But why did you not kill me? Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam said to him that, now he was addressing his potential murder, not even potential. They fought and his allies were killed. So Rasulullah was talking to his murderer. But this is the beauty of Rasulullah's outlook on life. He always saw the best in everything and everyone, and he cherished it, and he cultivated it, and he turned that person into the best version of themselves. Rasulullah spoke to this man who was planning to kill him and said, you have five qualities within you that I love and Allah loves. Among those qualities was generosity. You have karam. You are a giver. And that's very important, brothers and sisters, for us to be generous even during times that we barely have enough for ourselves. A man once came to Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam and said to him that I have a lot of kids and I'm incredibly poor and we barely have anything to eat and I'm struggling to make ends meet and put bread on the table and I just don't know what to do anymore. I'm so hopeless and we're in despair and please help us and this and that. Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam told him that if you have a loaf of bread, say there are five of you, cut that loaf of bread into six pieces and give one piece to charity. And the guy was like, we don't have anything to eat. I'm telling you, we're poor. You're telling me to give a piece of bread away to others? And Imam al-Sadiq said that, trust me, do it, and Allah will increase your provision. He did it for a few days, maybe a week or so. I don't exactly know. And he came back to Imam al-Sadiq afterwards and said, yes, Yabna Rasulullah, O son of the Prophet of God, you were right. It is through giving to others that we open the channels of Allah's blessings and favors toward ourselves. That's just how the system works. Because charity is an indication, a sign, and a manifestation of gratefulness. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said in the Holy Quran that لَإِن شَكَرْتُمْ لَأَزِيدَنَّكُمْ. If you are grateful, I will increase you. I will increase for you. And by giving to others, I'm giving thanks to Allah because I am valuing this blessing that He has given to me. I'm not belittling it by saying, oh, it's barely enough for us. How can I possibly share it with others? What I express in my actions and in my conduct, that I value this blessing that Allah has given to me, and whatever it is, because it's from Allah, it's in abundance. It is kathir. It is a lot of khair. It is a lot of goodness. And I acknowledge that, and I'm going to spread this goodness with others. And once Allah sees that sense of gratitude in us, that contentment that we have, even if it's little, we don't see it as little, we see it as a lot, because it's from our beloved, He increases it for us so that we may share more, we may spread more, and we may grow more. Thank you so very much for being with us on this episode of The Lantern. I hope you enjoyed it. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio.